This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, good morning. This is The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanesan. According to Forbes, by 2025, millennials will account for 75% of the global workforce, and that is going to greatly impact the concept of a workspace. Now, co-working spaces have become synonymous with the generation of millennials and their concept of work. However, is that enough to keep the sector of co-working spaces alive, or will we see this fad burn out like franchise gym memberships? To address this and more, I speak to Erman Akinchi, co-founder of Common Ground. Welcome to the show, Erman.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Erman, let's get straight into it. Is Common Ground and our co-working spaces just a millennial fad?
It's an interesting one, right? Because I think that, I mean, I hear that a lot. I think that, you know, if I go through and think about what I'm seeing on an industry level, I think that saying that it's a fad is probably like the lazy man's answer, or the lazy man's question to the industry. What I have been seeing in the world of co-working is a paradigm shift in the way that people work, what people expect from the workplace, and I don't see that changing or disappearing anytime soon. You know, you talked about millennials. Millennials, you know, there's so much data to show that millennials are fundamentally an experience-driven generation. And as there's more and more millennials entering the workplace, becoming a bigger part of workplace culture, I think that the need to create workspaces that have that experience as a part of it is going to be even more important. So I don't see it disappearing anytime soon.
Okay, but millennials currently are just a portion of the working community. And in order for any workspace to really thrive, you need to buy in from traditional businesses as well, and not just startups. Are you seeing that? What is your demographic mix in terms of consumers look like?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's really started to become more evident in the last 2 or 3 years. So if you look at our seat count mix, you would have about 60 to 65% are SMEs. And then you have about 5%, which are maybe smaller startups, freelancers. The remaining 30% are large MNCs, and that's been a new entry to the market. So we have large companies, you know, large multinational companies coming to us saying, hey, we want to work with you. We want to create a space together with you. That currently makes up about 30% of our seat count. We expect it to be at 40% by the end of this year.
Now, that's a significant portion right there. Are there any familiar names that we might know of?
We've worked with the likes of Petronas, UEM Magenta. We've just done 2 floors with Amazon Web Services. So there's some big names there.
So is this a workspace directly curated for those spaces, or are you seeing them enter your existing lots?
It's a combination, but the larger ones, predominantly, we would do a custom fit for those companies.
So that would be a shift in terms of the business model for you as well. Instead of just attracting membership, you're going out there and essentially building spaces for companies.
Absolutely. So I would say that it's a shift in the business model, but not a shift in the product.
And speaking of the product, right, a big part of that is the networking element. The better the network or the perception of the network at a co-working space, the more attractive it is for members to join. How dependent is Common Ground on that perception that networking and events play such a big role in the membership roster?
Oh, hugely. You know, I think that if you break down the product, you know, there's half of the value proposition, which is a desk and a chair and an internet connection, right? The functional utilitarian part of this. I think that that's, you know, the one of the major pillars of what we provide, but it's also the most commoditized. It's probably the oldest part of the value proposition. You've had guys like Regis, ServCorp, CEO Suites, you know, for the better part of the last three decades, giving people functional office space. What is different today is that people are looking for more than just a desk and a chair. People no longer want to go and sit in a dull, bleak room with fluorescent lights and nothing really happening. What they're looking for is that experience part. And how you create that experience and the value of that experience is really what's going to set you yourself aside from just an office space fit-out company. So we believe that that experience is made up of a number of things. Obviously, you know, the network and the community is a big part of that. Our benefits are a big part of that. All of that perception, all of that additional value is what's going to drive consumers towards us. That's what's going to get people excited, and that's what's going to keep people wanting more of our product. And so I think it's hugely important.
So then, based on that, is the core of the product that you're selling a sense of community?
I would say, I don't like to just use the word community because I think that community is one part of the overall value proposition. It's an experience. It's a lifestyle experience. And that's made up of so many different parts. Community is definitely a huge part of that. You know, we're inherently social creatures. We look for those kind of interactions. We enjoy those kind of interactions. And so if you can provide that as a part of your experience, I think that you're going down the right path. But if you just stopped there, I think you would probably fall short on a lot of the value.
Now, all that sounds it sounds great, right? The sense of community, bringing people together. But does it make financial sense? Is it sustainable in the longer run? In this age of unicorns, we're seeing a lot of businesses come out without what seems like a definite plan to profitability.
Mm-hmm.
How does your business model work, the co-working space? Is it just the membership fees?
No, actually, it's not. It's grown far beyond just the membership fees. And that's something that I'm actually really happy about. Going back to what you were asking with regards to the sustainability of the business model, I think the one thing that I really want to point out, especially about our business, is that Common Ground is already a break-even profitable business. You know, and so when it comes to discussing the legitimacy of the business model, I think that that's really the one thing that people need to acknowledge is that this business is already proven itself to be sustainable and have that longevity. I think that that's a big part. And I think that that's what attracted me to the business model. When I look at the unit economics, it makes a lot of sense, you know, with the types of margins that we see and the way that we can control the costs. It's highly sustainable.
So at current levels right now, I think you had 20 spaces at this point.
That's right.
So you have broke even and it is a sustainable business.
That's right. So, we're a profitable business. Where we need cash is actually to continue growing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the one thing that I think is that people may not necessarily appreciate. Like, we have to fund new venues and that costs, that's more capital. But that's capital. It's not operational.
So on an operational level, the business is sustainable.
Sustainable.
So all
profitable.
So in 2018, I think in June, you raised about $20 million at that point. So this is all going to expansion. And we mentioned just now 20 locations. Are you concerned that the more spaces you open up, that that you may cannibalize yourself in the longer term?
Look, there's always that concern, but the data that we look at shows us that we're probably not close to that point yet. And I think that the one thing that people don't appreciate about the business model is that the sphere of influence for a venue is actually relatively small. And that's because, co-working in essence is a convenience product. You know, if you're living in Ampang, it's very unlikely that you're going to choose to drive all the way to TTDI every single day for work if you have the choice. Co-working provides you with that kind of convenience. So people are typically gravitating towards a venue within sort of 2 kilometers of the venue. So we believe that because of that, then there's a lot of room to expand more and more.
But you're not the only co-working space expanding, and you've got actually a few competitors in the country itself. And we're going to get into that in just a few minutes. I'm speaking to Erman Akinci, co-founder of Common Ground. This is The Breakfast Grill. Stay tuned.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kunnison. I'm speaking to Erman Akinci, co-founder of Common Ground. Now, WeWork has been in the news a lot for its IPO plans. Now, with respect to yourselves, what is the end game here for Common Ground? Is it a matter of IPO, or is there a buyout in mind?
Yeah, so I mean, look, I think for us, our goals are really driven around Southeast Asia. I think that a business like this it relies on local execution so much, and you're not doing yourselves any favors thinking that you're going to go to Mongolia or Argentina and then be able to create the same kind of value proposition halfway across the world. And you know, the more money you have, obviously, changes that dynamic somewhat, but it's still something you're going to have to battle. And so for us, our big advantage in this part of the world is that we understand how to operate in this part of the world. We understand the culture in this part of the world. We understand site selection better in this part of the world. And that has given us a huge advantage over international players, WeWork being one of them. And I think that that's going to ultimately be the part of our business that I think, you know, gives us the most motivation and chance of carving out a regionally strong business. And I don't think that that's a new story. I think that, you know, if you look at local execution and the tech space, the first big story that comes to mind is Grab versus Uber. And I could see that dynamic playing out. I think ultimately for us, what we see is us having a great opportunity to build a really phenomenal regional business, which I think is going to be a lucrative one. And then in terms of, you know, what's the exit story, I actually find this one a really funny one because I think the two are somewhat linked, and I think that it misses out one major step, which is you need to build a good, solid, sustainable business. From there, your options actually broaden. You can potentially go for an IPO. You know, nobody wants to buy you if you're, you know, a flailing, about to die business. So, it, you know, like the story of selling to a competitor or a trade sale doesn't really matter, or an IPO doesn't really matter until you build a good business. So for us, you know, our real sort of short to medium term goals is to build a solid business. And then from there, we will start to explore what there might be. My preference would probably be leaning towards an IPO story, because I think that once you get to that point, unless somebody comes in and says, look, I'm going to pay an exorbitant amount for your business, you know, the kind of value extraction probably leans itself to maybe an IPO.
Now, let's talk about your competition, because you're not the only player in the field, but you are one of the bigger ones right now. With more co-working spaces coming onto the scene, how has this affected pressure for your pricing?
Yeah, I mean, look, competition is always going to have that effect on pricing. You know, it's just driving the margins down. But I think, you know, a couple of things that I've noticed and I'd like to point out is that because of the sphere of influence of the venues, the competition doesn't play out how people necessarily might appreciate. You know, so a venue, let's say, out in PJ doesn't compete directly with a venue in downtown KL because of the nature that I was discussing earlier and that smaller sphere of influence. You don't have that direct one-on-one competition with every single venue or every single competitor in the market. You're probably venue to venue, you're probably competing on a local level or on a neighborhood level a little bit more, but that's still somewhat painful. You know, we've seen a huge amount of entries to the market, some probably doing better than others, some with better products than others. All in all, obviously, it has a slightly painful effect. But it's something that I don't see lasting forever, because I think, you know, at the end of the day, I see a huge spectrum of product value and product quality. So I see a lot of people, you know, assuming that, you know, entry into the market's going to be easy because they just have to find a space, fit it out, and then they're going to start competing. And I think that that's probably a foolish mindset to have. And I see that ultimately, you know, that a lot of those players will maybe not last as long as they would like. And then I think, you know, for the guys that have a solid value proposition and have staying power, what you would find is that in the next couple of years, you're going to start to see a bit more consolidation, you know, and then larger co-working businesses kind of emerge out of that.
So with you being the largest player, mm-hmm. are you looking out for competitors to buy out, or are you going to just compete them out?
It really depends. I kind of grew up in an environment of always looking at opportunities to grow through acquisition. So it's something that I think comes quite naturally for me, and it's something that I would always continue to look at. But I've seen enough of it to know that you also have to be very careful as to how you go about it. You can't just buy everyone, because you can probably, you know, you can reduce the value more than you can create the value in certain circumstances. So you have to be very selective. For us, when we look across the spectrum of opportunities, there's several players that I think would really make a lot of sense coming together. There's some that you would probably argue aren't really going to be able to last much longer, and then you know, it's probably easier just to kind of stand back and watch those maybe fade away a little bit. We're looking at those opportunities actually as we speak. We're in discussions with lots of different players. But I think that the one thing that drives my thinking is that it needs to be sort of, you know, 1 + 1 = 3. And the way that we're trying to create that is that we've built so much great technology. We've got so many amazing revenue streams, additional revenue streams to bring to the table. What we're finding with a lot of the discussions and the partners that we're talking to in terms of merging or acquiring is that where you're going to get that 1 + 1 = 3 is those guys that have built a decent product. They've got, you know, good occupancy, but really they're limited because they've only relied on that one revenue stream, the membership revenue stream. And it would make a lot of sense to partner with us, where on day one, you can then start plugging in revenue stream 2, revenue stream 3, revenue stream 4. And then that business goes from being sort of, you haven't fundamentally changed much about what they're doing on a day-to-day basis, but you've already added so much value.
So how many players does Malaysia have space for in terms of number of brands?
So the thing is, okay, so if you look at the industry, the one thing I want to point out to people is that not all co-working businesses are created equal. And, you know, I think if you are really kind of strict about it, you can split up the industry into kind of two halves. The first one is the larger players like ourselves. We're typically doing, you know, north of 20,000 square foot per venue. At this point, you should probably have, you know, to the tune of 4 to 5 venues. If not, you're really in a sort of a lower tier. And then you have these other guys, which are kind of the smaller players. And, you know, that includes sort of the guy that's, you know, doing 2,000 square foot on top of a shop lot. Now, legitimately, he can call himself a co-working space, but I think that the kind of value proposition he brings to the table is so much more commoditized that in the long run, he'll struggle. And so for me, if you include all of those players, you have a lot of room for these smaller guys to probably still sit around. In terms of the bigger guys, you're probably looking at 3 or 4. You know, it's definitely not a winner take all model where, you know, there's only going to be like one rail ride sharing, or there's going to be, you know, like only one classifieds portal, or really one or two e-commerce sites. Co-working, because of that physical element, allows itself to have more players because, you know, the sphere of influence is a little bit smaller. Location propositions are very different. You know, you have a player who's positioned himself next to public transport, on top of a mall. You know, he's got great, you know, great connectivity. He's got great amenities. Even if you have a competitor that's kind of within that 2 kilometer radius, if he's not connected to those amenities and that transport, it's a very different proposition, and that creates a little bit more of a dynamic nature to it and allows for people to kind of exist within that ecosystem a little bit more. So I would probably say comfortably 4, maybe 5.
Okay, and before we end, Rahman, I want to ask you about expansion. Now, you've grown, you've got 20 at this point, 14 in Malaysia. What's that number going to look like at the end of this year or at the end of next year?
It's a good question. So a couple of interesting things to kind of note about how this plays out. It's hard to give an exact number because the one thing that we're very reliant on is participation from landlords. So, you know, whenever we talk to our investors, you know, the one thing that we're constantly wary of when committing to a timeline is that there's so much of this that's out of our hands. You know, we could say, hey, we want to have a location here, but, you know, if the landlord negotiation drags on 2-3 months, that changes our timeline tremendously. But I think from an overall perspective, I'd share with you, you know, a couple of broader industry stats. You know, you look at reports that are coming out from Colliers, from JLL, CBRE, all of them kind of lead down the same path, you know, and they're really predicting that co-working as an industry is, you know, going to probably sit at around sort of 30% of grade A office space in the next 10, 15 years, which is a phenomenal number. If you think about that, that's like, you know, 1 in 3 square foot is going to be allocated to co-working. I think if you look at that, assuming that that's correct, then you look at that growth rate, that's really going to be the trajectory that you're going to have to follow. And you need to kind of be in line with that. Your growth needs to be in line with that to really match the demand. I think I would argue that the last 2 or 3 years, you've had a little bit of pent-up demand. So you've seen faster than normal growth, but eventually it's going to level out to whatever that industry growth rate is. But then that being said, I think, you know, that's a pretty aggressive growth rate on its own. I mean, going to 30% of grade A office space, by our calculation, that's essentially a $5 billion US a year industry across Southeast Asia.
But how do you and your competitors keep up capital expansion like this? Is that even sustainable?
I mean, yes. I think ultimately it's sustainable because it's really about sort of your return on capital, and you know, the unit economics of it showed that there's significant return on capital. So in any environment where you're returning, you know, good numbers on the capital, you're always going to be able to sustain the idea of getting more capital in. It probably doesn't do, you know, wonders for your cap table. And you know, if you're a sort of an underfunded part of that story, then you can get diluted very quickly. But I would argue that, you know, from that perspective, you're not going to struggle to find capital to do that. But I also I see the logic on the other side, which is, look, you don't want to really be in a business that's super capital heavy. Although I would argue that there's a lot of businesses out there that are very capital heavy, and we've tried to approach that problem by working with our landlords and doing those partnership deals, and that's one way that we've been really successful at reducing the capital needs of the business. I mean, that's why we're so much larger than, you know, even our closest competitor here in Malaysia, is because, you know, we're working with the landlord. So, you know, whereas our competitors probably had enough capital to do 1, maybe 2 venues, 3 at the most, you know, we have 20 venues across 3 markets. And that's a function of sort of the business model that you use. I think that it's probably leaning closer to a hotel model than it is about renting space and then filling that space up.
And with that expansion, are you looking to raise more funds in the near future?
Oh, hopefully not. But yeah, it's always part of it, right? Like I said, it really becomes a function of of playing this three-dimensional, four-dimensional chess game of you want to grow at the rate that allows you to stay at the forefront of the industry. We don't need the money to operate, but we still need the money to put on new venues. And then and the equation always comes down to, like, you know, if you scale back and grow at a much more organic rate, which you could essentially do at this point, are you missing out on a greater opportunity because, you know, the industry is growing so fast that it would probably make more sense to, in the short term, take the dilution, get the capital in, and then fill out and build out more venues in the short term, because in the long term it'll pay off more. So we're constantly trying to balance those two things. You know, investors don't love the idea of constantly being diluted, so, you know, we're obviously wary of that and not trying to push that story too much.
All right, and on that note, thank you so much, Arman, for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
Now, I wish you all the best, and hope we get to hear another Asian story beating an American unicorn. That would be great to hear.
I would love that.
I've been speaking to Arman Akinchi, co-founder of Common Ground. This has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanisan, signing off for The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, Frost & Sullivan's Malaysia Mobile Service Provider of the Year.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.